I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and today I'm going to look at the initial phase of the Cold War from an American perspective, from 1945 to 48. We're going to look at some of the difficulties Truman had in formulating coherent Cold War policy. And again, we are looking at Grand Expectations by James Patterson, which is a good general reader on post-war America. The analysis that James Patterson has of Truman is that his initial phase of foreign policy from 45 to 48 is truncated into three distinct phases, and he writes, "In coping with the Soviet Union between 1945 and 48, Truman's foreign policies went through three interrelated phases. The first, lasting until early 1946, exposed a good deal of floundering and inconsistency as Truman sought to find himself. The second, dominant through to the end of 1946, revealed a little more floundering and uncertainty, but also a stiffening of purpose. Although Truman and his advisers still hoped to ameliorate gathering tensions, they made only half-hearted efforts to accommodate the Soviets or to even negotiate seriously with them. In the third phase, clear by February 1947, the administration had hit a more consistent, clearly articulated policy, containment. The essential stance of the United States for the next 40 years, the quest for containment entailed high expectations. It was the most important legacy of the Truman administration." Now, here's a kind of a thinking and learning error for most of us. This always happens in high school studies of the Cold War. It's assumed that those first 2 years of Truman's administration, where there's inconsistency and uncertainty, never happened, and we are straight into containment from 1945. And that's certainly not the case. In 1945-46, there's a lot of ambiguity, there's a lot of uncertainty, there's a lot of second-guessing Soviet intentions. Truman and the advisors that he'd inherited from Roosevelt, if you go back a few podcasts, I talked about that one, are involved in a kind of a very complicated dialogue in 1945 about what Soviet intentions actually are. So Truman, when he began to examine what was happening in Eastern Europe, his first sense is to be firm. He had not had any real foreign policy experience during the war. He'd been the vice president. He was in a kind of a backwater position, and it's Roosevelt that understood or thought he understood or Stalin, and had met Stalin, and had a as positive a working relationship with Stalin as probably any Western leader had ever had. Stalin, it was believed by Roosevelt, by Truman, was violating all the promises he made at Yalta. especially when it came to Poland. Roosevelt, it was believed by Truman, would have done something about this, would have resisted. Truman was determined to be as decisive and tough as possible, and he called Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, to the White House and gave him a dressing down. I think there was a podcast I did this a couple of years ago on this very topic, where Molotov essentially said, "I have never been spoken to in this manner before," and Truman said, "Get used to it because there's more." So 2 weeks after the death of Roosevelt, Truman has this showdown with Molotov. He has, there's no small talk, there are no pleasantries, and the quote is, "I have never been talked to like that in my life." Truman said in response, "Carry out your agreements and you won't get talked to like that." And so this was the first indication that the Soviets had that the Americans were going to bring pressure to bear, that the Americans were going to demand certain things of them. In addition to this, the American government decided to bring pressure to bear economically on the Soviet Union and suspend the offer of a loan that had been mooted by America to the Soviet Union of $6 billion. The second measure, which was taken just after Germany's surrender in May, ended lend-lease shipments to the USSR. Truman believed that American law meant that lend-lease was only operable during wartime, and the moment that it ended, it could be instantly terminated, or indeed should be instantly terminated. The reality, of course, is that Truman had more flexibility and was able to be far more kind of lenient than that if he chose to be. But he had cancelled, and ships that had set sail for the Soviet Union were told to return. This was an act that Stalin referred to as being brutal. He referred to it and done in a scornful and abrupt manner. So there was a sense by the Soviets that the respect that they believed that they had were due, and that they had earned, and that had indeed been offered by Roosevelt, was now being withdrawn. Truman believed that he was doing exactly what Roosevelt would have done. No doubt Roosevelt would have done things perhaps in a more subtle or diplomatic or more artful, skillful way. However, what Stalin perceived was that the positive policy towards the Soviet Union that Roosevelt had was now being cancelled, and a new kind of policy was being instituted. Truman was unable, despite all this, was unable to influence Soviet behaviour, and was unsure as to what leverage he could bring to bear on the Soviet Union. The answer was the Soviet Union had been devastated by the war. 27 million Soviet citizens had been killed. The country had been economically destroyed. And so there was surprisingly little leverage in the space of all this, in the context of all of this, that could keep Soviet troops out of Eastern Europe. One of the key reasons for a military occupation of Eastern Europe was to sap Eastern Europe of resources in order to rebuild the Soviet Union. So it didn't matter if $6 billion worth of aid was being turned around. The ability to suck the life out of Eastern Europe was far, far more important. Stalin responded by jailing, imprisoning 16 of the 20 Polish leaders of the anti-communist government who had perhaps naively returned to Poland from wartime exile in London. Stalin claimed that they had returned home to incite resistance to Soviet occupation forces, and these were the kind of the next wave of fascist anti-people's forces. Stalin allowed the other four who had not been jailed to participate in the Soviet-dominated puppet government, but by imposing Soviet control over Poland and similarly installing new regimes in Romania and Bulgaria, Stalin was announcing some new and pretty brutal Cold War realities to Europe and to the USA. The first of these is that Stalin was determined to make sure that his domination would extend over Eastern Europe. And the second was that he had the military power to do so. And it didn't matter what the Allies said in protest, that the facts on the ground were that there were millions of Soviet soldiers in Eastern Europe or ready to reinforce them from the Soviet Union. For Truman, as well as for other presidents, this was a sobering reality. The fact that America's military power had escalated so dramatically during the war led to, in some ways, a foreign policy a sort of unreality emerging that the USA was in some ways invincible, and the existence of Soviet soldiers in Eastern Europe was a kind of a powerful wake-up call for America, showing that irrespective of how many nuclear weapons America had, the Soviets had enough conventional firepower and manpower to really sort of tilt the balance in their favour. Truman reflected fairly quickly that his short words with Molotov had unnecessarily raised tensions, and that the Soviets had all the major cards to play. And so he dispatched Roosevelt's advisor, Harry Hopkins, to Moscow to try to speak directly with Stalin. There was the hope that this meeting might sort of reassure the Soviets that America and the Soviet Union were going to be able to get on okay. Following this visit to Moscow, Truman accepted Hopkins' suggestions that he should try to kind of come to some sort of accommodation over the question of Poland. Truman conceded that Stalin was okay to asset strip East Germany and other parts of Eastern Europe and dismantle factories and dismantle infrastructure, and that the Allies would very quickly be frozen out of any kind of joint control or Allied control commissions in any of the Eastern European countries, that these were Soviet fiefdoms. This was actually, I think, perhaps an astute piece of realpolitik or realpolitik that that Truman has subsequently been criticised for, of being sort of defeatist and surrenderist to the Soviet Union. But in reality, there was nothing short of a Third World War that the West could do, that Europe could, Western Europe could do, to ensure that the Soviets, the Communist parties, were adequately challenged in Eastern Europe. It was completely impossible.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Early 1945, within the first few weeks of Truman's administration, it was abundantly clear that in opinion polls across America, there was no appetite for further military overseas adventures. The war was over and people were satisfied with that. And 12 months later, the same polling shows the same position. Truman's ability to kind of acquiesce to Soviet demands over Eastern Europe obviously predates the testing and even the detonation of the atomic bomb. So the bomb to Americans even is an unknown quantity. At Yalta, when Stalin had promised to enter the war against Japan, this was at the negotiating of Roosevelt. And the plan was that the Soviet Union would enter the war against Japan 3 months after the defeat of Germany, and Truman was immensely kind of irritated, I suppose, that Roosevelt had agreed to this, which was essentially going to help the Soviets, in his view, get a foothold in Asia. So this would be August that the Soviet advance into Asia would begin. Secondly, so military advisors explained to Truman the obvious facts of life, that the Soviet army occupied much of Central and Eastern Europe and couldn't be dislodged. And the war, having ended in Europe, put pressures on the US for demobilization and reconversion to a peacetime economy rapidly. The USSR, being a dictatorship, being a dictatorship on a war footing, meant that it didn't have to demobilize rapidly. Demobilized American or British troops, or American or British troops facing demobilization and being left waiting, could become quite a handful, whereas in the Soviet Union, those that protested about their conditions faced either the firing squad or the gulag. So with these thoughts in mind, and knowing that there was no desire for any kind of a further conflict, certainly not with the Soviet Union amongst the American population, Truman went to Potsdam for his first and only meeting with Stalin. Later, Truman claimed that when he had returned from the conference, he was deeply disillusioned with the Soviets. At the time, however, it didn't appear to be like this at all. The diary that Truman wrote during the Potsdam Agreement indicated that he believed he could have a deal with Stalin, he could work with Stalin, and that Stalin was as near like Tom Pendergast as any man I know. Now, this is a curious compliment if you think about Tom Pendergast, who was one of the kind of the American, great American sort of political fixers who, during the 1920s and 30s, controlled Kansas City and Jackson County in Missouri, who was supposedly a straight shooter and a man who later helped launch Truman's career, somebody who supposedly always kept his word and was always honest, however, was a proper gangster was able to rub shoulders with organized crime within the city and subvert the democratic process and present and become, in his own right, a kind of quasi-autocrat within the city. So, actually, quite apt when talking about Stalin, but not meant that way. Truman, who had only recently been let in on the secrets of the atomic bomb, was in good spirits at the meeting because the news of the successful test in New Mexico had come through. This came to him on July the 16th, the day just before the Potsdam Conference opened. And it gave Truman an immense sense of self-confidence. Truman, who I think perhaps didn't feel particularly self-confident and perhaps a little bit out of his depth, having to deal with Churchill and Stalin, and being a relatively unknown figure, and far from being the statesman that Roosevelt had been, was buoyed up by the news of the atomic bomb. Churchill said at the time, "When Truman got to the meeting, and after having read the report, he was a changed man. He told the Russians just where they got off, and generally bossed the whole meeting." Some of the Americans at the conference, notably James Burns, the Secretary of State, also were emboldened by the news of the bomb, and they imagined and believed that having exclusivity to this bomb, along with being able to coerce the Soviets using economic policy, would really kind of cow Stalin and bring him to the negotiating table. Stalin, who apocryphally, when Truman explained that the Americans had a weapon of awesome destructive power, simply said, "Well, I hope you put it to good use against the Japanese." Already knew about the bomb. The Los Alamos spy ring had done its work, and Stalin was well aware of its existence. Truman was unsure initially whether he should tell Stalin about the power that America had. He was unsure about whether the Japanese should be warned. He wondered whether a weapon of such immense power should be used at all, and if so, under what circumstances. The dropping of the bombs had no effect on Soviet behaviour, and some historians have theorised that Truman wanted to present the Soviets with a demonstration of American power that would cause Soviet ambitions to be dampened, rather. Stalin was dismissive of America's atomic power and imposed his will far more stringently in Romania and Bulgaria. And having annexed a large chunk of eastern Poland, the Soviets gave the Poles a chunk of eastern Germany to compensate them for their troubles. They obviously created the satellite state of North Korea and hampered any efforts to reunite the peninsula. And the Soviets also refused to participate in the development of a stable post-war order, refusing to become part of the World Bank or the IMF, seeing that as a way in which capitalist institutions could gradually leech themselves into the Soviet Union. By the end of 1945, Stalin was also placing pressure on the Republic of Turkey for control over the Dardanelles, and also extending control into northern Iran. And so these kinds of southward pressures put the US once again in a kind of a reactive position, and particularly Truman, unsure about what to do. In previous podcasts, when I've talked about the establishment of the CIA, In part, one of the factors that saw the CIA come about was Truman's lack of knowledge about world affairs and about the kind of the current geopolitics that he was presented with, and a desire simply to be informed every day about what was going on. So the interesting part of this story is that after the Soviets, after the Americans detonate the atomic bomb, the Soviets were still able to really play Truman very successfully to take advantage of what they saw as weakness and indecision. The hope by Truman's Secretary of State, James Burns, that simply financial pressure on the Soviet Union would bring them to heel, really indicated that Truman and Burns between them didn't really have a clear idea about what to do. And they lacked clear understanding of what it was that was motivating the Soviets. By the end of 1945, writes James Patterson, it was becoming ever more clear that this was not happening, that the economic pressure placed on the Soviet Union was not working. Leading senators, including Tom Connolly of Texas, head of the Foreign Relations Committee, and Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, top Republican on the committee, came to Truman to complain that Burns was too willing to horse trade with the Soviets. Acheson, who was Under Secretary of State, meanwhile fretted at Burns's frequent absences from Washington and his inattention to orderly administration. The State Department fiddles while Burns roams, Wags were saying. Acheson and others in the State Department also tired of Burns's improvisational style of diplomacy. That might have worked well in the Senate, but Acheson believed was wholly inappropriate in dealing with the Russians. Burns, who had expected to be vice president, compounded his problems by patronising Truman and by failing to keep him informed of his discussions with allies and enemies. Truman, always sensitive to slights, grew increasingly irritated, referring privately to his able and conniving Secretary of State. So, in 1945 to 46, which is the first part of our kind of examination of Truman's journey through to the Truman Doctrine, Truman is really outsmarted by the Soviets, outclassed by Stalin, and has come from being a vice president, a kind of a backwater role, and is advised by another really prospective vice president in the guise of the Secretary of State, James Burns. So this gives us some big clues as to why American foreign policy towards the Soviet Union seemed to flounder 1945 to 46. Anyway, thanks for listening today, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye.